On writing. There are no bad dogs, according to the title of a popular training manual, but don't tell that to the parent of a child mauled by a pit bull or a Rottweiler. He or she is apt to bust your beak for you. And no matter how much I want to encourage the man or woman trying for the first time to write seriously, I can't lie and say there are no bad writers. Sorry, but there are lots of bad writers. Some are on staff at your local newspaper, usually reviewing little theater productions or pontificating about the local sports teams. Some have scribbled their way to homes in the Caribbean, leaving a trail of pulsing adverbs, wooden characters, and vile passive voice constructions behind them. Others hold forth at open mic poetry slams, wearing black turtlenecks and wrinkled khaki pants. They spout doggerel about my angry lesbian breasts and the tilted alley where I cried my mother's name. Writers form themselves into the pyramid we see in all areas of human talent and human creativity. At the bottom are the bad ones. Above them is a group which is slightly smaller but still large and welcoming. These are the competent writers. They may also be found on the staff of your local newspaper, on the racks at your local bookstore, and at poetry readings on open mic night. These are folks who somehow understand that although a lesbian may be angry, her breasts will remain breasts. The next level is much smaller. These are the really good writers. Above them, above almost all of us, are the Shakespeares, the Faulkners, the Yeatses, Shaws, and Eudora Welties. They are geniuses, divine accidents, gifted in a way which is beyond our ability to understand, let alone attain. Shit, most geniuses aren't able to understand themselves, and many of them lead miserable lives, realizing, at least on some level, that they are nothing but fortunate freaks, the intellectual version of runway models who just happen to be born with the right cheekbones and with breasts which fit the image of an age. I am approaching the heart of this book with two theses, both simple. The first is that good writing consists of mastering the fundamentals, vocabulary, grammar, the elements of style, and then filling the third level of your toolbox with the right instruments. The second is that while it is impossible to make a competent writer out of a bad writer, and while it is equally impossible to make a great writer out of a good one, it is possible, with lots of hard work, dedication, and timely help, to make a good writer out of a merely competent one. I'm afraid this idea is rejected by lots of critics and plenty of writing teachers as well. Many of these are liberals in their politics, but crustaceans in their chosen fields. Men and women who would take to the streets to protest the exclusion of African Americans or Native Americans, I can imagine what Mr. Strunk would have made of these politically correct but clunky terms, from the local country club are often the same men and women who tell their classes that writing ability is fixed and immutable. Once a hack, always a hack. Even if a writer rises in the estimation of an influential critic or two, he or she always carries his or her early reputation along, like a respectable married woman who was a wild child as a teenager. Some people never forget, that's all, and a good deal of literary criticism serves only to reinforce a caste system which is as old as the intellectual snobbery which nurtured it. Raymond Chandler may be recognized now as an important figure in 20th century American literature, an early voice describing the anomie of urban life in the years after World War II, but there are plenty of critics who will reject such a judgment out of hand. He's a hack! They cry indignantly. A hack with pretensions, the worst kind, the kind who thinks he can pass for one of us. Critics who try to rise above this intellectual hardening of the arteries usually meet with limited success. Their colleagues may accept Chandler into the company of the great, but are apt to seat him at the foot of the table. And there are always those whispers. Came out of the pulp tradition, you know. Carries himself well for one of those, doesn't he? Did you know he wrote for Black Mask in the 30s? Yes, regrettable. Even Charles Dickens, the Shakespeare of the novel, has faced a constant critical attack as a result of his often sensational subject matter, his cheerful fecundity, when he wasn't creating novels, he and his wife were creating children, and, of course, his success with the book-reading groundlings of his time and ours. Critics and scholars have always been suspicious of popular success. Often their suspicions are justified. In other cases, these suspicions are used as an excuse not to think. No one can be as intellectually slothful as a really smart person. Give smart people half a chance and they will ship their oars and drift, dozing to Byzantium, you might say. So yes, I expect to be accused by some of promoting a brainless and happy Horatio Alger philosophy, defending my own less than spotless reputation while I'm at it, and of encouraging people who are just not our sort, old chap, to apply for membership at the country club. I guess I can live with that. But before we go on, let me repeat my basic premise. If you're a bad writer, no one can help you become a good one, or even a competent one. If you're good and want to be great, forget about it. What follows is everything I know about how to write good fiction. I'll be as brief as possible because your time is valuable and so is mine, and we both understand that the hours we spend talking about writing is time we don't spend actually doing it. I'll be as encouraging as possible because it's my nature and because I love this job. I want you to love it too. But if you don't want to work your ass off, you have no business trying to write well. Settle back into competency and be grateful you have even that much to fall back on. There is a muse, but he's not going to come fluttering down into your writing room and scatter creative fairy dust all over your typewriter or computer station. He lives in the ground, and my version is a guy. He's a basement guy. You have to descend to his level, and once you get down there, you have to furnish an apartment for him to live in. You have to do all the grunt labor, in other words, while the muse sits and smokes cigars and admires his bowling trophies and pretends to ignore you. Do you think this is fair? I think it's fair. He may not be much to look at, that muse guy, and he may not be much of a conversationalist. What I get out of mine is mostly surly grunts unless he's on duty, but he's got the inspiration. It's right that you should do all the work and burn all the midnight oil, because the guy with the cigar and the little wings has got a bag of magic. There's stuff in there that can change your life. Believe me, I know. If you want to be a writer, you must do two things above all others: read a lot and write a lot. There's no way around these two things that I'm aware of. No shortcut. I'm a slow reader, but I usually get through 70 or 80 books a year, mostly fiction. I don't read in order to study the craft. I read because I like to read. It's what I do at night, kicked back in my blue chair. Similarly, I don't read fiction to study the art of fiction, but simply because I like stories. Yet there is a learning process going on. Every book you pick up has its own lesson or lessons, and quite often the bad books have more to teach than the good ones. When I was in the eighth grade, I happened upon a paperback novel by Murray Leinster, a science fiction pulp writer who did most of his work during the 40s and 50s, when magazines like Amazing Stories paid a penny a word. I have read other books by Mr. Leinster, enough to know that the quality of his writing was uneven. This particular tale, which was about mining in the asteroid belt, was one of his less successful efforts. Only, that's too kind. It was terrible, actually, a story populated by paper-thin characters and driven by outlandish plot developments. Worst of all, or so it seemed to me at the time, Leinster had fallen in love with the word zestful. Characters watched the approach of ore-bearing asteroids with zestful smiles. Characters sat down to supper aboard their mining ship with zestful anticipation. Near the end of the book, the hero swept the large-breasted blonde heroine into a zestful embrace. For me, it was the literary equivalent of a smallpox vaccination. I have never, so far as I know, used the word zestful in a novel or a story. God willing, I never will. Asteroid Miners, which wasn't the title, but that's close enough, was an important book in my life as a reader. Almost everyone can remember losing his or her virginity, and most writers can remember the first book he or she put down thinking, I can do better than this. Hell, I am doing better than this. What could be more encouraging to the struggling writer than to realize his or her work is unquestionably better than that of someone who actually got paid for his or her stuff? One learns most clearly what not to do by reading bad prose. One novel like Asteroid Miners or Valley of the Dolls, Flowers in the Attic, and The Bridges of Madison County, to name just a few, is worth a semester at a good writing school, even with the superstar guest lecturers thrown in. Good writing, on the other hand, teaches the learning writer about style, graceful narration, plot development, the creation of believable characters, and truth-telling. A novel like The Grapes of Wrath may fill a new writer with feelings of despair and good old-fashioned jealousy. I'll never be able to write anything that good, not if I live to be 1,000. But such feelings can also serve as a spur, goading the writer to work harder and aim higher. Being swept away by a combination of great story and great writing, of being flattened, in fact, is part of every writer's necessary formation. You cannot hope to sweep someone else away by the force of your writing unless it has been done to you. So, we read to experience the mediocre and the outright rotten. Such experience helps us to recognize those things when they begin to creep into our own work and to steer clear of them. We also read in order to measure ourselves against the good and the great, to get a sense of all that can be done. And we read in order to experience different styles. You may find yourself adopting a style you find particularly exciting, and there's nothing wrong with that. When I read Ray Bradbury as a kid, I wrote like Ray Bradbury, everything green and wondrous and seen through a lens smeared with the grease of nostalgia. When I read James M. Cain, everything I wrote came out clipped and stripped and hard-boiled. When I read Lovecraft, my prose became luxurious and Byzantine. I wrote stories in my teenage years where all these styles merged, creating a kind of hilarious stew. This sort of stylistic blending is a necessary part of developing one's own style, but it doesn't occur in a vacuum. You have to read widely, constantly refining and redefining your own work as you do so. It's hard for me to believe that people who read very little, or not at all in some cases, should presume to write and expect people to like what they have written, but I know it's true. If I had a nickel for every person who ever told me he or she wanted to become a writer but didn't have time to read, I could buy myself a pretty good steak dinner. Can I be blunt on this subject? If you don't have time to read, you don't have the time or the tools to write. Simple as that. Reading is the creative center of a writer's life. I take a book with me everywhere I go and find there are all sorts of opportunities to dip in. The trick is to teach yourself to read in small sips as well as in long swallows. Waiting rooms were made for books, of course, but so were theater lobbies before the show, long and boring checkout lines, and everyone's favorite, the John. You can even read while you're driving, thanks to the audiobook revolution. Of the books I read each year, anywhere from 6 to 12 are on tape. As for all the wonderful radio you will be missing, come on, how many times can you listen to Deep Purple sing Highway Star? Reading at meals is considered rude in polite society, but if you expect to succeed as a writer, rudeness should be the second to least of your concerns. The least of all should be polite society and what it expects. If you intend to write as truthfully as you can, your days as a member of polite society are numbered anyway. Where else can you read? There's always the treadmill or whatever you use down at the local health club to get aerobic. I try to spend an hour doing that every day, and I think I'd go mad without a good novel to keep me company. Most exercise facilities, at home as well as outside it, are now equipped with TVs, but TV, while working out or anywhere else, really is about the last thing an aspiring writer needs. If you feel you must have the news analyst blowhards on CNN while you exercise, or the stock market blowhards on MSNBC, or the sports blowhards on ESPN, it's time for you to question how serious you really are about becoming a writer. You must be prepared to do some serious turning inward toward the life of the imagination, and that means, I am afraid, that Geraldo, Keith Olbermann, and Jay Leno must go. Reading takes time, and the glass tit takes too much of it. Once weaned from the ephemeral craving for TV, most people will find they enjoy the time they spend reading. I'd like to suggest that turning off that endlessly quacking box is apt to improve the quality of your life as well as the quality of your writing. And how much of a sacrifice are we talking about here? How many Frasier and ER reruns does it take to make One American Life complete? How many Richard Simmons infomercials? How many white boy, fat boy, beltway insiders on CNN? Oh, man, don't get me started. Jerry Springer, Dr. Dre, Judge Judy, Jerry Falwell, Donnie and Marie, I rest my case. When my son Owen was 7 or so, he fell in love with Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, particularly with Clarence Clemons, the band's burly sax player. Owen decided he wanted to learn to play like Clarence. My wife and I were amused and delighted by this ambition. We were also hopeful, as any parent would be, that our kid would turn out to be talented, perhaps even some sort of prodigy. We got Owen a tenor saxophone for Christmas and lessons with Gordon Bowie, one of the local music men. Then we crossed our fingers and hoped for the best. 7 months later, I suggested to my wife that it was time to discontinue the sax lessons if Owen concurred. Owen did, and with palpable relief. He hadn't wanted to say it himself, especially not after asking for the sax in the first place, but 7 months had been long enough for him to realize that, while he might love Clarence Clemons's big sound, the saxophone was simply not for him. God had not given him that particular talent. I knew, not because Owen stopped practicing, but because he was practicing only during the periods Mr. Bowie had set for him. Half an hour after school, 4 days a week, plus an hour on the weekends. Owen mastered the scales and the notes, nothing wrong with his memory, his lungs, or his eye-hand coordination. But we never heard him taking off, surprising himself with something new, blissing himself out. And as soon as his practice time was over, it was back into the case with the horn, and there it stayed until the next lesson or practice time. What this suggested to me was that when it came to the sax in my son, there was never going to be any real play time. It was all going to be rehearsal. That's no good. If there's no joy in it, it's just no good. It's best to go on to some other area where the deposits of talent may be richer and the fun quotient higher. Talent renders the whole idea of rehearsal meaningless. When you find something at which you are talented, you do it, whatever it is, until your fingers bleed or your eyes are ready to fall out of your head. Even when no one is listening or reading or watching, every outing is a bravura performance because you, as the creator, are happy, perhaps even ecstatic. That goes for reading and writing as well as for playing a musical instrument, hitting a baseball, or running the 440. The sort of strenuous reading and writing program I advocate, 4 to 6 hours a day, every day, will not seem strenuous if you really enjoy doing these things and have an aptitude for them. In fact, you may be following such a program already. If you feel you need permission to do all the reading and writing your little heart desires, however, consider it hereby granted by yours truly. The real importance of reading is that it creates an ease and intimacy with the process of writing. One comes to the country of the writer with one's papers and identification pretty much in order. Constant reading will pull you into a place, a mindset, if you like that phrase, where you can write eagerly and without self-consciousness. It also offers you a constantly growing knowledge of what has been done and what hasn't, what is trite and what is fresh, what works and what just lies there dying or dead on the page. The more you read, the less apt you are to make a fool of yourself with your pen or word processor. If read a lot, write a lot is the great commandment, and I assure you that it is, how much writing constitutes a lot? That varies, of course, from writer to writer. One of my favorite stories on the subject, probably more myth than truth, concerns James Joyce. According to the story, a friend came to visit him one day and found the great man sprawled across his writing desk in a posture of utter despair. "James, what's wrong?" the friend asked. "Is it the work?" Joyce indicated assent, without even raising his head to look at the friend. "Of course it was the work. Isn't it always?" "How many words did you get today?" the friend pursued. Joyce, still in despair, still sprawled face down on his desk. 7. 7? But James, that's good, at least for you. Yes, Joyce said, finally looking up. I suppose it is. But I don't know what order they go in. At the other end of the spectrum, there are writers like Anthony Trollope. He wrote humongous novels. Can You Forgive Her is a fair enough example. For modern audiences, it might be retitled Can You Possibly Finish It? And he pumped them out with amazing regularity. His day job was as a clerk in the British Postal Department, the red public mailboxes all over Britain were Anthony Trollope's invention. He wrote for 2.5 hours each morning before leaving for work. This schedule was ironclad. If he was in mid-sentence when the 2.5 hours expired, he left that sentence unfinished until the next morning. And if he happened to finish one of his 600-page heavyweights with 15 minutes of the session remaining, he wrote, the end, set the manuscript aside, and began work on the next book. John Creasy, a British mystery novelist, wrote 500, yes, you heard me correctly, novels under 10 different names. I've written 35 or so, some of Trollopean length, and am considered prolific, but I look positively blocked next to Creasy. Several other contemporary novelists, they include Ruth Rendell / Barbara Vine, Evan Hunter / Ed McBain, Dean Koontz, and Joyce Carol Oates, have written easily as much as I have. Some have written a good deal more. On the other hand, the James Joyce hand, there is Harper Lee, who wrote only one book, the brilliant To Kill a Mockingbird. Any number of others, including James Agee, Malcolm Lowry, and Thomas Harris so far, wrote under 5, which is okay, but I always wonder two things about these folks. How long did it take them to write the books they did write, and what did they do the rest of their time? Knit Afghans? Organize church bazaars? Deify plums? I'm probably being snotty here, but I'm also, believe me, honestly curious. If God gives you something you can do, why in God's name wouldn't you do it? My own schedule is pretty clear-cut. Mornings belong to whatever is new, the current composition. Afternoons are for naps and letters. Evenings are for reading, family, Red Sox games on TV, and any revisions that just cannot wait. Basically, mornings are my prime writing time. Once I start work on a project, I don't stop and I don't slow down unless I absolutely have to. If I don't write every day, the characters begin to stale off in my mind. They begin to seem like characters instead of real people. The tale's narrative cutting edge starts to rust, and I begin to lose my hold on the story's plot and pace. Worst of all, the excitement of spinning something new begins to fade. The work starts to feel like work, and for most writers, that is the smooch of death. Writing is at its best, always, 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 when it is a kind of inspired play for the writer. I can write in cold blood if I have to, but I like it best when it's fresh and almost too hot to handle. I used to tell interviewers that I wrote every day except for Christmas, the 4th of July, and my birthday. That was a lie. I told them that because if you agree to an interview, you have to say something, and it plays better if it's something at least half clever. Also, I didn't want to sound like a workaholic dweeb, just a workaholic, I guess. The truth is that when I'm writing, I write every day, workaholic dweeb or not. That includes Christmas, the 4th, and my birthday. At my age, you try to ignore your goddamn birthday anyway. And when I'm not working at all, although during those periods of full stop, I usually feel at loose ends with myself and have trouble sleeping. For me, not working is the real work. When I'm writing, it's all the playground, and the worst 3 hours I ever spent there were still pretty damn good. I used to be faster than I am now. One of my books, The Running Man, was written in a single week, an accomplishment John Creasy would perhaps have appreciated, although I have read that Creasy wrote several of his mysteries in 2 days. I think it was quitting smoking that slowed me down. Nicotine is a great synapse enhancer. The problem, of course, is that it's killing you at the same time it's helping you compose. Still, I believe the first draft of a book, even a long one, should take no more than 3 months, the length of a season. Any longer, and for me at least, the story begins to take on an odd foreign feel, like a dispatch from the Romanian Department of Public Affairs, or something broadcast on high-band shortwave during a period of severe sunspot activity. I like to get 10 pages a day, which amounts to 2,000 words. That's 180,000 words over a three-month span, a goodish length for a book, something in which the reader can get happily lost if the tale is done well and stays fresh. On some days, those 10 pages come easily. I'm up and out and doing errands by 11:30 in the morning, perky as a rat and liverwurst. More frequently, as I grow older, I find myself eating lunch at my desk and finishing the day's work around 1:30 in the afternoon. Sometimes, when the words come hard, I'm still fiddling around at tea time. Either way is fine with me, but only under dire circumstances do I allow myself to shut down before I get my 2,000 words. The biggest aid to regular trilopian production is working in a serene atmosphere. It's difficult for even the most naturally productive writer to work in an environment where alarms and excursions are the rule rather than the exception. When I'm asked for the secret of my success, an absurd idea that, but impossible to get away from, I sometimes say there are two. I stayed physically healthy, at least until a van knocked me down by the side of the road in the summer of 1999, and I stayed married. It's a good answer because it makes the question go away, and because there is an element of truth in it. The combination of a healthy body and a stable relationship with a self-reliant woman who takes zero shit from me or anyone else has made the continuity of my working life possible. And I believe the converse is also true, that my writing and the pleasure I take in it has contributed to the stability of my health and my home life. You can read anywhere, almost, but when it comes to writing, library carrels, park benches, and rented flats should be courts of last resort. Truman Capote said he did his best work in motel rooms, but he is an exception. Most of us do our best in a place of our own. Until you get one, you'll find your new resolution to write a lot hard to take seriously. Your writing room doesn't have to sport a Playboy philosophy decor, and you don't need an early American roll-top desk in which to house your writing implements. I wrote my first two published novels, Carrie and Salem's Lot, in a laundry room of a double-wide trailer, pounding away on my wife's portable Olivetti typewriter and balancing a child's desk on my thighs. John Cheever reputedly wrote in the basement of his Park Avenue apartment building near the furnace. The space can be humble, probably should be, as I think I have already suggested, and it really needs only one thing, a door which you are willing to shut. The closed door is your way of telling the world and yourself that you mean business. You have made a serious commitment to write and intend to walk the walk as well as talk the talk. By the time you step into your new writing space and close the door, you should have settled on a daily writing goal. As with physical exercise, it would be best to set this goal low at first to avoid discouragement. I suggest 1,000 words a day, and because I'm feeling magnanimous, I'll also suggest that you can take one day a week off, at least to begin with. No more. You'll lose the urgency and immediacy of your story if you do. With that goal set, resolve to yourself that the door stays closed until that goal is met. Get busy putting those 1,000 words on paper or on a floppy disk. In an early interview, this was to promote Carrie, I think, a radio talk show host asked me how I wrote. My reply, one word at a time, seemingly left him without a reply. I think he was trying to decide whether or not I was joking. I wasn't. In the end, it's always that simple, whether it's a vignette of a single page or an epic trilogy like The Lord of the Rings, the work is always accomplished one word at a time. The door closes the rest of the world out. It also serves to close you in and keep you focused on the job at hand. If possible, there should be no telephone in your writing room, certainly no TV or video games for you to fool around with. If there's a window, draw the curtains or pull down the shades, unless it looks out at a blank wall. For any writer, but for the beginning writer in particular, it's wise to eliminate every possible distraction. If you continue to write, you will begin to filter out these distractions naturally, but at the start, it's best to try and take care of them before you write. I work to loud music. Hard rock stuff like AC/DC, Guns N' Roses, and Metallica have always been particular favorites. But for me, the music is just another way of shutting the door. It surrounds me, keeps the mundane world out. When you write, you want to get rid of the world, do you not? Of course you do. When you're writing, you're creating your own world. I think we're actually talking about creative sleep. Like your bedroom, your writing room should be private, a place where you go to dream. Your schedule, in at about the same time every day, out when your 1,000 words are on paper or disk, exists in order to habituate yourself, to make yourself ready to dream, just as you make yourself ready to sleep by going to bed at roughly the same time each night and following the same ritual as you go. In both writing and sleeping, we learn to be physically still at the same time we are encouraging our minds to unlock from the humdrum rational thinking of our daytime lives. And as your body and mind grow accustomed to a certain amount of sleep each night, 6 hours, 7, maybe the recommended 8, so can you train your waking mind to sleep creatively and work out the vividly imagined waking dreams, which are successful works of fiction. But you need the room, you need the door, and you need the determination to shut the door. You need a concrete goal as well. The longer you keep to these basics, the easier the act of writing will become. Don't wait for the muse. As I've said, he's a hard-headed guy who's not susceptible to a lot of creative fluttering. This isn't the Ouija board or the spirit world we're talking about here, but just another job like laying pipe or driving long-haul trucks. Your job is to make sure the muse knows where you're going to be every day from 9 till noon or 7 till 3. If he does know, I assure you that sooner or later he'll start showing up, chomping his cigar and making his magic. So, okay, there you are in your room with the shade down and the door shut and the plug pulled out of the base of the telephone. You've blown up your TV and committed yourself to 1,000 words a day come hell or high water. Now comes the big question. What are you going to write about? And the equally big answer, anything you damn well want, anything at all, as long as you tell the truth. The dictum in writing classes used to be, write what you know, which sounds good, but what if you want to write about starships exploring other planets, or a man who murders his wife and then tries to dispose of her body with a wood chipper? How does the writer square either of these or 1,000 other fanciful ideas with the write what you know directive? I think you begin by interpreting write what you know as broadly and inclusively as possible. If you're a plumber, you know plumbing, but that is far from the extent of your knowledge. The heart also knows things, and so does the imagination. Thank God. If not for heart and imagination, the world of fiction would be a pretty seedy place. It might not even exist at all. In terms of genre, it's probably fair to assume that you will begin by writing what you love to read. Certainly, I have recounted my early love affair with the EC horror comics until the tale has gone stale. But I did love them, ditto horror movies like I Married a Monster from Outer Space, and the result was stories like I Was a Teenage Grave Robber. Even today, I'm not above writing slightly more sophisticated versions of that tale. I was built with a love of the night and the unquiet coffin, that's all. If you disapprove, I can only shrug my shoulders. It's what I have. If you happen to be a science fiction fan, it's natural that you should want to write science fiction. And the more SF you've read, the less likely it is that you'll simply revisit the field's well-mined conventions, such as space opera and dystopian satire. If you're a mystery fan, you'll want to write mysteries. And if you enjoy romances, it's natural for you to want to write romances of your own. There's nothing wrong with writing any of these things. What would be wrong, I think, is to turn away from what you know and like or love the way I love those old ECs and black and white horror flicks in favor of things you believe will impress your friends, relatives, and writing circle colleagues. What's equally wrong is the deliberate turning toward some genre or type of fiction in order to make money. It's morally wonky, for one thing. The job of fiction is to find the truth inside the story's web of lies, not to commit intellectual dishonesty in the hunt for the buck. Also, brothers and sisters, it doesn't work. When I'm asked why I decided to write the sort of thing I do write, I always think the question is more revealing than any answer I could possibly give. Wrapped within it, like the chewy stuff in the center of a Tootsie Pop, is the assumption that the writer controls the material instead of the other way around. The writer who is serious and committed is incapable of sizing up story material the way an investor might size up various stock offerings, picking out the ones which seem likely to provide a good return. If it could indeed be done that way, every novel published would be a bestseller, and the huge advances paid to a dozen or so big-name writers would not exist. Publishers wouldn't like that. Grisham, Clancy, Crichton, and myself, among others, are paid these large sums of money because we are selling uncommonly large numbers of books to uncommonly large audiences. A critical assumption is sometimes made that we have access to some mystical vulgate that other, and often better, writers either cannot find or will not deign to use. I doubt if this is true. Nor do I believe the contention of some popular novelists, although she was not the only one. I am thinking of the late Jacqueline Suzanne, that their success is based on literary merit, that the public understands true greatness in ways the tight-assed, consumed by jealousy literary establishment cannot. This idea is ridiculous, a product of vanity and insecurity. Book buyers aren't attracted by and large by the literary merits of a novel. Book buyers want a good story to take with them on the airplane, something that will first fascinate them, then pull them in and keep them turning the pages. This happens, I think, when readers recognize the people in a book, their behaviors, their surroundings, and their talk. When the reader hears strong echoes of his or her own life and beliefs, he or she is apt to become more invested in the story. I'd argue that it's impossible to make this sort of connection in a premeditated way, gauging the market like a racetrack tout with a hot tip. Stylistic imitation is one thing, a perfectly honorable way to get started as a writer, and impossible to avoid, really. Some sort of imitation marks each new stage of a writer's development. But one cannot imitate a writer's approach to a particular genre, no matter how simple what that writer is doing may seem. You can't aim a book like a cruise missile, in other words. People who decide to make a fortune writing like John Grisham or Tom Clancy produce nothing but pale imitations, by and large, because vocabulary is not the same thing as feeling, and plot is light years from the truth as it is understood by the mind and the heart. When you see a novel with, in the tradition of John Grisham, Patricia Cornwell, Mary Higgins Clark, Dean Koontz, on the cover, you know you are looking at one of these overcalculated and likely boring imitations. Write what you like, then imbue it with life and make it unique by blending in your own personal knowledge of life, friendship, relationships, sex, and work. Especially work. People love to read about work. God knows why, but they do. If you're a plumber who enjoys science fiction, you might well consider a novel about a plumber aboard a starship or on an alien planet. Sound ludicrous? The late Clifford D. Simak wrote a novel called Cosmic Engineers, which is close to just that, and it's a terrific read. What you need to remember is that there's a difference between lecturing about what you know and using it to enrich the story. The latter is good. The former is not. Consider John Grisham's breakout novel, The Firm. In this story, a young lawyer discovers that his first job, which seemed too good to be true, really is. He's working for the mafia. Suspenseful, involving and paced at breakneck speed, the firm sold roughly 9 gazillion copies. What seemed to fascinate its audience was the moral dilemma in which the young lawyer finds himself. Working for the mob is bad, no argument there, but the frocking pay is great. You can drive a Beamer, and that's just for openers. Audiences also enjoyed the lawyer's resourceful efforts to extricate himself from his dilemma. It might not be the way most people would behave, and the deus ex machina clanks pretty steadily in the last 50 pages, but it is the way most of us would like to behave, and wouldn't we also like to have a deus ex machina in our lives? Although I don't know for sure, I'd bet my dog and lot that John Grisham never worked for the mob. All of that is total fabrication, and total fabrication is the fiction writer's purest delight. He was once a young lawyer, though, and he has clearly forgotten none of the struggle. Nor has he forgotten the location of the various financial pitfalls and honey traps that make the field of corporate law so difficult. Using plain-spun humor as a brilliant counterpoint and never substituting cant for story, he sketches a world of Darwinian struggle where all the savages wear three-piece suits. And here's the good part. This is a world impossible not to believe. Grisham has been there, spied out the land and the enemy positions, and brought back a full report. He told the truth of what he knew, and for that, if nothing else, he deserves every buck the firm made. Critics who dismissed The Firm and Grisham's later books as poorly written, and who profess themselves to be mystified by his success, are either missing the point because it's so big and obvious, or because they are being deliberately obtuse. Grisham's make-believe tale is solidly based in a reality he knows, has personally experienced, and which he wrote about with total, almost naive, honesty. The result is a book which is, cardboard characters or no, we could argue about that, both brave and uniquely satisfying. You, as a beginning writer, would do well not to imitate the lawyers in trouble genre Grisham seems to have created, but to emulate Grisham's openness and inability to do anything other than to get right to the point. John Grisham, of course, knows lawyers. What you know makes you unique in some other way. Be brave. Map the enemy's positions. Come back. Tell us all you know. And remember that Plumbers in Space is not such a bad setup for a story. In my view, stories and novels consist of three parts. Narration, which moves the story from point A to point B and finally to point Z. Description, which creates a sensory reality for the reader. And dialogue, which brings characters to life through their speech. You may wonder where plot is in all this. The answer, my answer anyway, is nowhere. I won't try to convince you that I've never plotted any more than I'd try to convince you that I've never told a lie, but I do both as infrequently as possible. I distrust plot for two reasons. First, because our lives are largely plotless, even when you add in all our reasonable precautions and careful planning. And second, because I believe plotting and the spontaneity of real creation aren't compatible. It's best that I be as clear about this as I can. I want you to understand that my basic belief about the making of stories is that they pretty much make themselves. The job of the writer is to give them a place to grow, and to transcribe them, of course. If you can see things this way, or at least try to, we can work together comfortably. If, on the other hand, you decide I'm crazy, that's fine. You won't be the first. During the course of an interview for The New Yorker, I told the interviewer, Mark Singer, that I believed stories are found things, like fossils in the ground. He said he didn't believe me. I replied that that was fine, as long as he believed that I believed it. And I do. Stories aren't souvenir T-shirts or Game Boys. Stories are relics, part of an undiscovered pre-existing world. The writer's job is to use the tools in his or her toolbox to get as much of each one out of the ground intact as possible. Sometimes the fossil you uncover is small, a seashell. Sometimes it's enormous, a Tyrannosaurus rex with all those gigantic ribs and grinning teeth. Either way, short story or thousand-page whopper of a novel, the techniques of excavation remain basically the same. No matter how good you are, no matter how much experience you have, it's probably impossible to get the entire fossil out of the ground without a few breaks and losses. To get even most of it, the shovel must give way to more delicate tools, air hose, palm pick, perhaps even a toothbrush. Plot is a far bigger tool, the writer's jackhammer. You can liberate a fossil from hard ground with a jackhammer, no argument there, but you know as well as I do that the jackhammer is going to break almost as much stuff as it liberates. It's clumsy, mechanical, anti-creative. Plot is, I think, the good writer's last resort and the dullard's first choice. The story which results from it is apt to feel artificial and labored. I lean more heavily on intuition and have been able to do that because my books tend to be based on situation rather than story. Some of the ideas which have produced these books are more complex than others, but the majority start out with the stark simplicity of a department store window display or a waxwork tableau. I want to put a group of characters, perhaps a pair, perhaps even just one, in some sort of predicament and then watch them try to work themselves free. My job isn't to help them work their way free or manipulate them to safety. Those are jobs which require the noisy jackhammer of plot, but to watch what happens and then write it down. The situation comes first. The characters, always flat and unfeatured to begin with, come next. Once these things are fixed in my mind, I begin to narrate. I often have an idea of what the outcome may be, but I have never demanded of a set of characters that they do things my way. On the contrary, I want them to do things their way. In some instances, the outcome is what I visualized. In most, however, it's something I never expected. For a suspense novelist, this is a great thing. I am, after all, not just the novel's creator, but its first reader. And if I'm not able to guess with any accuracy how the damn thing is going to turn out, even with my inside knowledge of coming events, I can be pretty sure of keeping the reader in a state of page-turning anxiety. And why worry about the ending anyway? Why be such a control freak? Sooner or later, every story comes out somewhere. In the early 1980s, my wife and I went to London on a combined business-pleasure trip. I fell asleep on the plane and had a dream about a popular writer. It may or may not have been me, but it sure to God wasn't James Caan, who fell into the clutches of a psychotic fan living on a farm somewhere out in the back of the beyond. The fan was a woman isolated by her growing paranoia. She kept some livestock in the barn, including her pet pig, Misery. The pig was named after the continuing main character in the writer's best-selling Bodice Rippers. My clearest memory of this dream upon waking was something the woman said to the writer, who had a broken leg and was being kept prisoner in the back bedroom. I wrote it on an American Airlines cocktail napkin so I wouldn't forget it, then put it in my pocket. I lost it somewhere, but can still remember most of what I wrote down. She speaks earnestly, but never quite makes eye contact. A big woman and solid all through. She is an absence of hiatus. Whatever that means. Remember, I just woken up. I wasn't trying to be funny in a mean way when I named my pig Misery. No, sir. Please don't think that. No, I named her in the spirit of fan love, which is the purest love there is. You should be flattered. Tabby and I stayed at Brown's Hotel in London, and on our first night there, I was unable to sleep. Some of it was what sounded like a trio of little girl gymnasts in the room directly above ours. Some of it was undoubtedly jet lag, but a lot of it was that airline cocktail napkin. Jotted on it was the seed of what I thought could be a really excellent story, one that might turn out funny and satiric as well as scary. I thought it was just too rich not to write. I got up, went downstairs, and asked the concierge if there was a quiet place where I could work longhand for a bit. He led me to a gorgeous desk on the second-floor stair landing. It had been Rudyard Kipling's desk, he told me with perhaps justifiable pride. I was a little intimidated by this intelligence, but the spot was quiet and the desk seemed hospitable enough. It featured about an acre of cherry wood working surface, for one thing. Stoked on cup after cup of tea, I drank it by the gallon when I wrote, unless I was drinking beer, that is. I filled 16 pages of a steno notebook. I like to work longhand, actually. The only problem is that once I get jazzed, I can't keep up with the lines forming in my head, and I get frazzled. When I called it quits, I stopped in the lobby to thank the concierge again for letting me use Mr. Kipling's beautiful desk. "I'm so glad you enjoyed it," he replied. He was wearing a misty, reminiscent little smile, as if he had known the writer himself. Kipling died there, actually, of a stroke, while he was writing. I went back upstairs to catch a few hours' sleep, thinking of how often we are given information we really could have done without. The working title of my story, which I thought would be a novella of about 30,000 words, was The Annie Wilkes Edition. When I sat down at Mr. Kipling's beautiful desk, I had the basic situation, crippled writer, psycho fan, firmly fixed in my mind. The actual story did not as then exist. Well, it did, but as a relic buried, except for 16 handwritten pages, that is, in the earth. But knowing the story wasn't necessary for me to begin work. I had located the fossil. The rest, I knew, would consist of careful excavation. I'd suggest that what works for me may work equally well for you. If you are enslaved to or intimidated by the tiresome tyranny of the outline and the notebook filled with character notes, it may liberate you. At the very least, it will turn your mind to something more interesting than developing the plot. An amusing sidelight. The century's greatest supporter of developing the plot may have been Edgar Wallace, a best-selling potboiler novelist of the 1920s. Wallace invented and patented a device called the Edgar Wallace plot wheel. When you got stuck for the next plot development or needed an amazing turn of events in a hurry, you simply spun the plot wheel and read what came up in the window. A fortuitous arrival, perhaps, or heroine declares her love. These gadgets apparently sold like hotcakes. By the time I had finished that first Brown's Hotel session, in which Paul Sheldon wakes up to find himself Annie Wilkes's prisoner, I thought I knew what was going to happen. Annie would demand that Paul write another novel about his plucky, continuing character, Misery Chastain, one just for her. After first demurring, Paul would of course agree. A psychotic nurse, I thought, could be very persuasive. Annie would tell him she intended to sacrifice her beloved pig, Misery, to this project. Misery's return would, she'd say, consist of but one copy, a holographic manuscript bound in pigskin. Here we'd fade out, I thought, and return to Annie's remote Colorado retreat 6 or 8 months later for the surprise ending. Paul is gone, his sick room turned into a shrine to Misery Chastain. But Misery the pig is still very much in evidence, grunting serenely away in her sty beside the barn. On the walls of the Misery room are book covers, stills from the Misery movies, pictures of Paul Sheldon, perhaps a newspaper headline reading, "Famed romance novelist still missing." In the center of the room, carefully spotlighted, is a single book on a small table, a cherrywood table, of course, in honor of Mr. Kipling. It is the Annie Wilkes edition of Misery's Return. The binding is beautiful, and it should be. It is the skin of Paul Sheldon. And Paul himself? His bones might be buried behind the barn, but I thought it likely that the pig would have eaten the tasty parts. Not bad, and it would have made a pretty good story. Not such a good novel, however. No one likes to root for a guy over the course of 300 pages, only to discover that between chapters 16 and 17, the pig ate him. But that wasn't the way things eventually went. Paul Sheldon turned out to be a good deal more resourceful than I initially thought, and his efforts to play Scheherazade and save his life gave me a chance to say some things about the redemptive power of writing that I had long felt but never articulated. Annie also turned out to be more complex than I'd first imagined her, and she was great fun to write about. Here was a woman pretty much stuck with cock-a-doodle brat when it came to profanity, but who felt absolutely no qualms about chopping off her favorite writer's foot when he tried to get away from her. In the end, I felt that Annie was almost as much to be pitied as to be feared. And none of the story's details and incidents proceeded from plot. They were organic, each arising naturally from the initial situation, each an uncovered part of the fossil. And I'm writing all of this with a smile. As sick with drugs and alcohol as I was much of the time, I had such fun with that one. Gerald's Game and The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon are two other purely situational novels. If Misery is two characters in a house, then Gerald is one woman in a bedroom, and The Girl Who is one kid lost in the woods. As I told you, I have written plotted novels, but the results in books like Insomnia and Rose Madder have not been particularly inspiring. These are, much as I hate to admit it, stiff, trying-too-hard novels. The only plot-driven novel of mine which I really like is The Dead Zone, and in all fairness, I must say I like that one a great deal. One book which seems plotted, Bag of Bones, is actually another situation, widowed writer in a haunted house. The backstory of Bag of Bones is satisfyingly gothic, at least I think so, and very complex, but none of the details were premeditated. The history of TR-90 and the story of what widowed writer Mike Noonan's wife was really up to during the last summer of her life arose spontaneously. All those details were part of the fossil, in other words. A strong enough situation renders the whole question of plot moot, which is fine with me. The most interesting situations can usually be expressed as a what-if question. What if vampires invaded a small New England village? Salem's Lot. What if a policeman in a remote Nevada town went berserk and started killing everyone in sight? Desperation. What if a cleaning woman suspected of a murder she got away with, her husband, fell under suspicion for a murder she did not commit, her employer, Dolores Claiborne? What if a young mother and her son became trapped in their stalled car by a rabid dog, Cujo? These were all situations which occurred to me while showering, while driving, while taking my daily walk, and which I eventually turned into books. In no case were they plotted, not even to the extent of a single note jotted on a single piece of scrap paper, although some of the stories, Dolores Claiborne, for instance, are almost as complex as those you find in murder mysteries. Please remember, however, that there is a huge difference between story and plot. Story is honorable and trustworthy. Plot is shifty and best kept under house arrest. Each of the novels summarized above was smoothed out and detailed by the editorial process, of course, but most of the elements existed to begin with. A movie should be there in rough cut, the film editor Paul Hirsch once told me. The same is true of books. I think it's rare that incoherence or dull storytelling can be solved by something so minor as a second draft. This isn't a textbook, and so there aren't a lot of exercises, but I want to offer you one now, in case you feel that all this talk about situation replacing plot is so much woolly-headed bullshit. I am going to show you the location of a fossil. Your job is to write 5 or 6 pages of unplotted narration concerning this fossil. Put another way, I want you to dig for the bones and see what they look like. I think you may be quite surprised and delighted with the results. Ready? Here we go. Everyone is familiar with the basic details of the following story. With small variations, it seems to pop up in the police beat section of Metropolitan Daily Papers every other week or so. A woman, caller Jane, marries a man who is bright, witty, and pulsing with sexual magnetism. We'll call this guy Dick. It's the world's most Freudian name. Unfortunately, Dick has a dark side. He's short-tempered, a control freak, perhaps even, you'll find this out as he speaks and acts, a paranoid. Jane tries mightily to overlook Dick's faults and make the marriage work. Why she tries so hard is something you will also find out. She will come on stage and tell you. They have a child, and for a while things seem better. Then, when the little girl is three or so, the abuse and the jealous tirades begin again. The abuse is verbal at first, then physical. Dick is convinced that Jane is sleeping with someone, perhaps someone from her job. Is it someone specific? I don't know, and don't care. Eventually, Dick may tell you who he suspects. If he does, we'll both know, won't we? At last, poor Jane can't take it anymore. She divorces the schmuck and gets custody of their daughter, little Nell. Dick begins to stalk her. Jane responds by getting a restraining order, a document about as useful as a parasol in a hurricane, as many abused women will tell you. Finally, after an incident which you will write in vivid and scary detail, a public beating perhaps, Richard the Schmuck is arrested and jailed. All of this is backstory. How you work it in and how much of it you work in is up to you. In any case, it's not the situation. What follows is the situation. One day, shortly after Dick's incarceration in the city jail, Jane picks up little Nell at the daycare center and ferries her to a friend's house for a birthday party. Jane then takes herself home, looking forward to 2 or 3 hours' unaccustomed peace and quiet. Perhaps, she thinks, I'll take a nap. It's a house she's going to, even though she's a young working woman. The situation sort of demands it. How she came by this house and why she has the afternoon off are things the story will tell you and which will look neatly plotted if you come up with good reasons. Perhaps the house belongs to her parents. Perhaps she's house-sitting. Perhaps another thing entirely. Something pings at her just below the level of consciousness as she lets herself in, something that makes her uneasy. She can't isolate it and tells herself it's just nerves, a little fallout from her 5 years of hell with Mr. Congeniality. What else could it be? Dick is under lock and key, after all. Before taking her nap, Jane decides to have a cup of herbal tea and watch the news. Can you use that pot of boiling water on the stove later on? Perhaps. Perhaps. The lead item on Action News at 3 is a shocker. That morning, three men escaped from the city jail, killing a guard in the process. Two of the three bad guys were recaptured almost at once, but the third is still at large. None of the prisoners are identified by name, not in this newscast at least, but Jane, sitting in her empty house, which you will now have plausibly explained, knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that one of them was Dick. She knows because she has finally identified that ping of unease she felt in the foyer. It was the smell, faint and fading, of Vitalis hair tonic. Dick's hair tonic. Jane sits in her chair, her muscles lax with fright, unable to get up. And as she hears Dick's footfalls begin to descend the stairs, she thinks, only Dick would make sure he had hair tonic, even in jail. She must get up, must run, but she can't move. It's a pretty good story, yes? I think so, but not exactly unique. As I've already pointed out, estranged hubby beats up, or murders, ex-wife, makes the paper every other week, sad but true. What I want you to do in this exercise is change the sexes of the antagonist and protagonist before beginning to work out the situation in your narrative. Make the ex-wife the stalker, in other words. Perhaps it's a mental institution she's escaped from instead of the city jail. The husband, the victim. Narrate this without plotting. Let the situation and that one unexpected inversion carry you along. I predict you will succeed swimmingly, if, that is, you are honest about how your characters speak and behave. Honesty in storytelling makes up for a great many stylistic faults, as the work of wooden prose writers like Theodore Dreiser and Ayn Rand shows. But lying is the great unrepairable fault. Liars prosper, no question about it, but only in the grand sweep of things, never down in the jungles of actual composition, where you must take your objective one bloody word at a time. If you begin to lie about what you know and feel while you're down there, everything falls down. When you finish your exercise, drop me a line at www.stephenking.com and tell me how it worked for you. I can't promise to vet every reply, but I can promise to read at least some of your adventures with great interest. I'm curious to know what kind of fossil you dig up and how much of it you are able to retrieve from the ground intact. Description is what makes the reader a sensory participant in the story. Good description is a learned skill, one of the prime reasons why you cannot succeed unless you read a lot and write a lot. It's not just a question of how to, you see. It's also a question of how much to. Reading will help you answer how much, and only reams of writing will help you with the how. You can learn only by doing. Description begins with visualization of what it is you want the reader to experience. It ends with your translating what you see in your mind into words on the page. It's far from easy. As I've said, we've all heard someone say, "Man, it was so great," or "so horrible, strange, funny. I just can't describe it." If you want to be a successful writer, you must be able to describe it, and in a way that will cause your reader to prickle with recognition. If you can do this, you will be paid for your labors, and deservedly so. If you can't, you're going to collect a lot of rejection slips and perhaps explore a career in the fascinating world of telemarketing. Thin description leaves the reader feeling bewildered and nearsighted. Overdescription buries him or her in details and images. The trick is to find a happy medium. It's also important to know what to describe and what can be left alone while you get on with your main job, which is telling a story. I'm not particularly keen on writing which exhaustively describes the physical characteristics of the people in the story and what they're wearing. I find wardrobe inventory particularly irritating. If I want to read descriptions of clothes, I can always get a J. Crew catalog. I can't remember many cases where I felt I had to describe what the people in a story of mine looked like. I'd rather let the reader supply the faces, the builds, and the clothing as well. If I tell you that Carrie White is a high school outcast with a bad complexion and a fashion victim wardrobe, I think you can do the rest, can't you? I don't need to give you a pimple-by-pimple, skirt-by-skirt rundown. We all remember one or more high school losers, after all. If I describe mine, it freezes out yours, and I lose a little bit of the bond of understanding I want to forge between us. Description begins in the writer's imagination, but should finish in the reader's. When it comes to actually pulling this off, the writer is much more fortunate than the filmmaker, who is almost always doomed to show too much, including, in 9 cases out of 10, the zipper running up the monster's back. I think locale and texture are much more important to the reader's sense of actually being in the story than any physical description of the players. Nor do I think that physical description should be a shortcut to character, so spare me, if you please, the hero's sharply intelligent blue eyes and outthrust determined chin. Likewise, the heroine's arrogant cheekbones. This sort of thing is bad technique and lazy writing, the equivalent of all those tiresome adverbs. For me, good description usually consists of a few well-chosen details that will stand for everything else. In most cases, these details will be the first ones that come to mind. Certainly, they will do for a start. If you decide later on that you'd like to change, add, or delete, you can do so. It's what rewrite was invented for. But I think you will find that in most cases, your first visualized details will be the truest and best. You should remember, and your reading will prove it over and over again should you begin to doubt, that it's as easy to over-describe as to under-describe, probably easier. One of my favorite restaurants in New York is the steakhouse Palm 2 on 2nd Avenue. If I decide to set a scene in Palm 2, I'll certainly be writing about what I know, as I've been there on a number of occasions. Before beginning to write, I'll take a moment to call up an image of the place, drawing from my memory and filling my mind's eye, an eye whose vision grows sharper the more it is used. I call it a mental eye because that's the phrase with which we're all familiar, but what I actually want to do is open all my senses. This memory search will be brief but intense, a kind of hypnotic recall. And as with actual hypnosis, you'll find it easier to accomplish the more you attempt it. The first four things which come to my mind when I think of Palm 2 are A, the darkness of the bar and the contrasting brightness of the back bar mirror, which catches and reflects light from the street. B, the sawdust on the floor. C, the funky cartoon caricatures on the walls. D, the smells of cooking steak and fish. If I think longer, I can come up with more stuff. What I don't remember, I'll make up. During the visualization process, fact and fiction become entwined. But there's no need for more. This isn't the Taj Mahal we're visiting, after all, and I don't want to sell you the place. It's also important to remember, it's not about the setting anyway. It's about the story, and it's always about the story. It will not behoove me, or you, to wander off into thickets of description just because it would be easy to do. We have other fish and steak to fry. Bearing that in mind, here's a sample bit of narration which takes a character into Palm 2. The cab pulled up in front of Palm 2 at 3:45 on a bright summer afternoon. Billy paid the driver, stepped out onto the sidewalk, and took a quick look around for Martin. Not in sight. Satisfied, Billy went inside. After the hot clarity of Second Avenue, Palm 2 was as dark as a cave. The back bar mirror picked up some of the street glare and glimmered in the gloom like a mirage. For a moment it was all Billy could see, and then his eyes began to adjust. There were a few solitary drinkers at the bar. Beyond them, the maitre d', his tie undone and his shirt cuffs rolled back to show his hairy wrists, was talking with a bartender. There was still sawdust sprinkled on the floor, Billy noted, as if this were a 20 speakeasy instead of a millennium eatery where you couldn't smoke, let alone spit a gob of tobacco between your feet. And the cartoons dancing across the walls, gossip column caricatures of downtown political hustlers, newsmen who had long since retired or drunk themselves to death, celebrities you couldn't quite recognize, still gambled all the way up to the ceiling. The air was redolent of steak and fried onions, all of it the same as it ever was. The maitre d' stepped forward. "Can I help you, sir? We don't open for dinner until 6, but the bar..." "I'm looking for Richie Martin," Billy said.